Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Hello, this is Dr. Miller. Welcome back to Conversations with Extraordinary People, where our goal is to look beyond the superficial and reveal the essence, to explore hidden dimensions of life's challenges, and discover new and powerful ways of healing, balancing, and optimizing the function of your body, your mind, emotion, behavior, and spirit. In each episode, we bring you intelligent conversations, practical tools, and experiential guided imagery meditations to integrate the wisdom our guest brings us at both the personal and the collective level. Today's guest is Margot Silk Forrest, whose voice you may be familiar with from my CD, which is entitled Inner Child Healing. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. Margot is a writer and an editor, and she's someone who likes to think deeply about life. She is the author of a number of books, including her first, which is A Short Course in Kindness. And now her work has matured into her guiding others who are writing books about things that they believe in. Her belief is that people have wonderful things to say, and she'd like to help them put it into books. She's written a book on EMDR with Francine Shapiro and co-authored a number of other books. When I met her, she was doing a newsletter entitled The Healing Woman. So, welcome to Conversations with Extraordinary People, Margot.
Thank you so much, Emmett. I'm just honored to be here.
Thank you. And what we try to do here is to take a look at the arc of one's life. Our belief is that each of us has certain intrinsic values of what is really important to us. And when we become aware of what our values are, and as we see the world as it is, and as we are aware of what our skills and our talents and our gifts are, we become aware that we have a purpose in life or a mission. And that may change as we mature through life. And it's so important for us to be able to discern those things within ourselves. And you're someone whose life, I think, helps to make clear how this can happen. So let's start early on in your life. And what do you feel were some of the experiences that you had that helped to propel you in the direction that you have been moving?
That's, of course, an interesting question, but for me, it's especially interesting because these experiences took two entirely different courses or channels. One was, they're all mixed together, so I'll give them to you that way. I grew up in a family, one brother, mother, father, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And my mother was hugely loving. She just taught us that we were the most special beings in the universe, and she was full of laughter and kindness, and she was also an alcoholic. So sometimes she was there, and sometimes she was not there. And that increased as I grew older. And then My father was a brilliant Philadelphia lawyer, actually. deeply ethical. And he was also a child molester in that he molested me from the time I was tiny until I was 10, and my parents separated and then divorced, which this was back in like 1960, and people didn't do that, so much so that some of my friends at school, their moms wouldn't let them come over to play anymore. I mean, we can't imagine that nowadays, but that was how that was, certainly in suburban Philadelphia back then. So the divorce left me with what could have been a stigma, but on an interior level, I was extremely relieved. and my mother, my brother, and I went off to live our life. Now, the other huge factor of my life, which I actually think is where the kindness book found its roots, was my brother, who was 3 years older than I was. His name was Gil, and he was an extraordinarily kind and funny person. It's sort of hard to describe, but he not only was the protective older brother, but he was kind all around. That was his way of walking in the world. Now, he wasn't like a milksop. He was very lively, extremely witty. He became a lawyer, too, but a very different kind of lawyer. And he could always make me laugh at myself. In fact, the last time we spoke on the phone, I had just gotten a nice promotion. I was working at Hewlett-Packard, and he was teasing me because I didn't get a raise along with a promotion, because in those days, that wasn't how the company worked. You got your promotion, and the next time increases were on their calendar, you got your raise. And he says, what do you mean, Marg? You got this new job, and there's a lot more work. And there's a lot more responsibility. But you didn't get any more money? And he had me laughing so hard. He was always able to get me to laugh really hard until, like, tears would come down my face. And a week later, I got a call that he had died in his sleep. He was 38, and I was absolutely devastated, as you can imagine. But there was a way in which he gave me his mantle of kindness to the world. That he was, I can't think of anything higher compliment in my life to have someone say to me, oh, you remind me so much of Gil. Not that I want to be his clone, I don't at all, but he was a happy person, and he made people around him happy. And in a genuine way, not like giving out compliments, but helping them be who they were.
When were you aware of the fact that you had been abused?
You know, I did not recover any memories of this until the month after I turned 40, which apparently is not unusual that a watershed moment in life can open up the psyche. So up until then, I just thought, well, I had a cold, distant father and alcoholic mother, and my brother dies on me when I'm 35, my only brother. And so, of course, I'm depressed, and of course, I'm anxious, and of course, I'm a workaholic. So what else is new? And then, for my 40th birthday, I gave myself the gift of a month-long meditation retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh over at his retreat center in France, Palm Village. And I came back from that feeling so serene, so absolutely grounded and clear. And that lasted for about 3 days. And then I was in some sort of blind panic. I just wanted to grab my cat and jump in the car and drive away from my life. And I couldn't figure out why. And then about a week after that, I started having dreams. And I had been working with a psychiatrist for years around depression. And he said, well, why don't you just follow the dreams and see where they lead? And they led to flashbacks and more dreams that were very thinly veiled, and I started to read up on some of the literature about repressed memories. There wasn't a whole lot at that point outside the professional realm.
And what year was that about?
That was 1990.
And what was the initial impact of that discovery for you?
That's such a good question. The odd thing is I've done so much healing around it, I can't actually remember what the initial impact was. I do remember talking to my psychiatrist about it, and he'd say, I said, so what do you think? Was I molested as a child? And he said, I can't tell you that, but if you we could act as if that were so, and treat you as if that were so, and then we should be able to see. And eventually I had such very clear memories that it was clear to me I had been molested. So we pretty much, from there, I actually shifted to working with a woman therapist who specialized in people who've been molested as children, and we did a whole range of therapies. It went on for quite some time. I was, looking back, I'd have to say I was staggered by the information, but I was more staggered when I took the toll of the damage it had done and saw its footprints in every room in my life.
In what way?
Well, that I had been trying to go through life wearing 100-pound backpack I had no idea was there. I had been trying to please people so they wouldn't hurt me, I think. I later recovered more memories of my grandfather molesting me as well, and the nursery school I went to being used for filming young children in sexual positions. I mean, it begins to sound like one of these stories you stop believing, you know. But that was my experience, and those were my memories, and my behaviors fit the memories. So it matched up for me, and it wasn't like I was going to file a lawsuit against the nursery school that had closed 40 years ago anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It was simply it helped me make sense of my life. And it was true in a very deep way. So that's what I worked with. And it took a long time. And what interesting happened is, at the time this happened, I had been working for Hewlett Packard. I was a manager of a group of technical writers. I had, earlier in my life, been a newspaper journalist, and I'd done some magazine writing. And I'd always been in the word arena. In fact, I'd gotten a job with Hewlett Packard as a technical writer, and then they promoted me to manager, which was a good thing because I wasn't a particularly great technical writer, but I loved working with people. But once I had opened up into this deeper world of the psyche of what was happening to me and what was happening to other people, because, of course, I started going to self-help groups for people who were molested and hearing other stories, and would leave those rooms reeling from the damage that people had suffered and were still walking around and trying to heal. So it became clear to me that I wanted to do something about this,
mm-hmm.
and not just for myself, that I had gifts of language and management skills I'd been taught by the high-tech world,
mm-hmm.
and I could reach out. So I decided to publish a newsletter for women who've been molested as children and to offer self-help and community. Isolation is such a big factor when you've been abused, or it was back then.
Mm-hmm.
So not many people were talking about it at all, and it still can make you feel like you're the only one and you don't want to talk about it. So I started publishing a little 12-page newsletter on soothing pink paper. It seemed to me that all of this needed to be as calm and loving as possible. I called it The Healing Woman, because it was all about healing. And we managed to find our subscribers through therapists and through some self-help groups things like that. And I and the people I free talked in the writing for me wrote about the things people were doing to heal. And there was some inspirational quotations, and there were little news articles if they were helpful. But mostly it was people either writing from a practical standpoint, or maybe some therapists. Sometimes I would interview therapists, or I'd interview survivors who had of abuse who had recovered. At one point, I actually, through a therapist friend, had a man who had molested his daughter come clean about it, actually served some time, gotten out of prison, made peace with his daughter, fully, deeply apologized to her. And he wrote an open letter of apology that we published. It was extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to talk to him on the phone. You can imagine I was like, no, I don't know. But my friend who's a therapist said, this is the real thing. And he and his daughter have a whole new relationship now, and he's genuine. And so we published it. I published a letter of apology from a mother who hadn't seen what was happening with her daughter. So that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And when did you become aware of the frequency with which this kind of molestation takes place?
Well, there are always statistics on it, and even back then, at the cusp of the 1990s, the statistics were that one in three women had been in some way sexually abused before they were 17. But I think it was one of those things at the time of society where people were starting once again to talk about this issue, and when you open those doors, it feels like floodgates are opening, that you start hearing from all sorts of people. I mean, I think the first issue I published had 125 subscribers, and 5 years later, we had 17,000 readers in all 50 states and 17 countries.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. And we consider that this is a readership who does not want anyone to know what they're reading.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent these out in envelopes, right? It's, privacy. They don't want to be discovered in the first place. We don't want to talk about it. I feel terrible to talk about. I always thought it would be a great business case study for Harvard Business School. Let's find yourself this market that doesn't want to be identified and doesn't want anything to do with you. But if you can get past that, they really need and benefit from.
Uh-huh. And of course, in those days, newsletters were mailed out, weren't they?
That was one of our biggest hurdles, was the cost of doing that.
Yeah.
If we had the internet, would probably still be going strong.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Boy! And what did you learn in the process of producing that and interacting with people?
I learned that the human heart is 100% resilient. I learned that mothers are willing to do the deepest, hardest healing to make a new world for their children. So many of the people who came to us, we put on a couple of conferences, and I used to go around and give talks and classes to people. So many of them were mothers, young mothers, who were there because they didn't want to be bad mothers to their children.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to give their children the best possible life and knew that they were suffering so much themselves, they couldn't do that without help. So I remember one conference after I gave my talk, a woman came up to me and shook my hand, and she had a couple of kids with her. This was just at a hotel and everything. And she shook my hand and said, "I just want to thank you for saving my life." And I was so touched. And I said, "Well, you're welcome. I'm glad something I said helped." She said, "No, I want to thank you not just for saving my life, but for saving my children's lives." And that was probably the best moment of the entire time. I ran the Healing Woman, and the saving her life was simply speaking the truth and offering hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. And what kind of hope can one offer in a situation like that?
Well, our mission from the start, doing the Healing Woman, was to say, to deliver the message that you are not alone and this can be healed. You can recover from this. I know it totally doesn't feel like it, but you can. It's hard work, but there are people out there who will help you do it, and you can get through it, and you can meet recovery every month in these pages. The fact that we're doing this newsletter, the stories that we tell, the articles. I had my primary guideline for my writers was not that they run spell checker, but that they end their stories on a positive note. That I was very aware that this pink paper that we were sending out was going to people who had nobody else to talk to. And they had to close the issue feeling hopeful and positive and part of a community that they may never see face to face, but that they weren't alone. So, and if we're not alone, we can face pretty much anything. So.
Wow. And what a wonderful service you certainly did provide.
Yeah.
And did that help you with your own healing?
Oh, absolutely, fantastically. I mean, I would say I should have stayed in therapy longer before starting the Healing Woman, because it was rough at first to be trying to deal with huge issues of my own while offering other people help with the same issues. I would be I don't know if there was any arrogance in there. Maybe I should confess a little arrogance so I can help them, you know. But it was very much where I think it meant a lot to people that I was walking the same path, because I wrote every month about where I was in my journey and the ways in which I would trip and fall and the things that were hard for me. I tried to be very careful about having healthy boundaries, where I didn't share personal information I wasn't ready to share. But I was there with them, and that process of speaking my truth was deeply healing.
Yeah, you mentioned an arrogance, and you know, maybe that's some of what is the kind of codependence that that's commonly seen when people come from an abused background. You're put into a situation where you feel alone. I mean, I don't know what situation can make a person feel any more alone. Is that when they're being abused by someone who supposedly would love them? Even more than if it's a stranger abuse, but there's still an enormous amount of aloneness. And the ego, in order to survive, the ego can kind of retreat. You can sort of abandon you, and you can sort of go off into psychosis or extreme obsessive compulsive or some other reaction formation, which is a kind of a healthy thing for the ego to do, which is to suppress the memory of the experience and anything associated with that memory as much as possible, and instead to decide, since I'm alone, I have to be responsible. So I'm going to be responsible to suppress this memory and do everything I can to make this not happen again. Maybe I'll get A's in school, or I'll become a tap dancer, or I'll become the problem solver of the family, or the cook, or the maid, or the or the community psychiatrist junior, or whatever.
Yeah.
And part of the healing often is learning how to give yourself the same attention and love that you've given others. It's almost as if there is within us already the sense of what it is to love and be loved, something in us that knows that children and babies should be loved, that that's the natural thing. And even though at those moments we didn't feel loved at all during the time of abuse, and yet there's something inside that says, no, there's supposed to be love. And since it's not coming from the outside, it's going to come from the inside. And so often you find the most loving, the most giving people will come from these backgrounds of abuse. And part of the healing is to say, okay, now you can take care of yourself before you've worked your fingers down to nubs trying to take care of the rest of the world and resign as general manager of the universe and start to heal that child inside.
Yes.
And kind of which is where we got together, which was you and I, which was in the 90s, wasn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can recall what led me to it. A couple of things that I had discovered toward the end of the 70s, because my original research had been with doing deep age regression analysis through hypnosis and with the people I was seeing in my practice. And all of a sudden, I started becoming aware of the fact that there's this huge amount of sexual abuse that was going on that no one ever talked about. And everyone was still sticking the Freud's notion that it was just a fantasy that females came up with because they had penis envy or whatever. It's a wait a minute. So I had been doing that work in my own private world, and then one day, and then my daughter was 11 years old at the time, so I can really spot the point that she said, "Dad," she said, "I look into the faces of adults, and when I do, I see a sad child. I think that there's a sad child inside of all these adults." And I said, "Oh, uh-huh." And she said, "Dad, isn't there something we can do about that? Can't we help that child that's inside?" And that was right at the time I had become aware of your work. And I said, "Okay, I have an idea." And that's what led to creating that program that we call the Inner Child Healing. And so we got together, and we'll take a short break, and right after the break, we'll come back and talk a little bit more about our experience and where you've gone since then. Just a reminder to our listeners that you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People, which is a publicly supported program. That means that we don't have advertising. You can support us by visiting our online store at shopdrmiller.com, shopdrmiller.com. And there you'll find my audio and video programs featuring self-help, healing, and peak performance guided imagery meditations, as well as a huge amount of learning. It's a very deep and very broad website. It'll take you many days if you wanted to read everything that's there. And you can learn more about today's guest at you have a website people can reach you?
I do. I have a couple, but probably the easiest to remember is ashortcourseinkindness.com.
ashortcourseinkindness.com. Great. And, okay, so let's get back to our show. So we got together, and I'm going to play a little bit of that program in a while so people can get a sense of it. And one of the things is I really loved your voice and your way of speaking. It came across as very loving and genuine, and gentle and I think very maternal. It's kind of how I felt about it, or at least how the little child inside of me felt about it.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
And of course, back at that time, women were having particularly women who had been abused, had enormously difficult time hearing a man's voice, much less being able to relax and listen to a man's voice. My knowledge of how to heal the psyche is to first get rid of the distractions, to relax completely, to open the mind, because the mind, kind of like a parachute, only works if it's open, and to be able to relax and to accept healing and wise information, to let that information in. And I thought, okay, the plan was that I would interact with you, we would discuss a few things, give people some guidance as to how to heal when there has been abuse or trauma of any kind. It didn't have to be sexual, because actually we've all been traumatized living in this completely psychotic culture that we live in. And then the side two, we would guide people into relaxation using both of our voices. Your voice and mine would kind of produce the yin and the yang, the male-female balance, and after we would guide people into that deep state of relaxation, and there my daughter Erin would speak directly to the inner child within the listener. So it was a wonderful experience, and you know, over the last 15, 20 years, there's been wonderful responses that I've heard from people who've taken the time to listen to it. And it was also a wonderful learning and growing experience for Erin. And her name at that time was Lauren, and she decided that she really associated the name Lauren with a lot of kind of negative experiences that she had had in rubbing up against this sort of nitpicking, catty culture of children in the third, fourth, fifth grades and so forth. She decided she would change her name, and she changed it to Erin because that felt strong to her. And she changed her whole personality, and she became, the strong woman, the strong girl. But at the same time, very healing and very kind and very loving and supporting of other people, and has turned into a wonderful leader, community leader. So it was a wonderful experience for her and for me too. So that was where we got together, and I began recommending your newsletter to people and so forth. What do you remember of our getting together at that time?
I remember how terrific your daughter was. That's what I walked away from there thinking, I wish I lived next door to them. Your wife is also terrific. I remember that. And the three of us being there, and then, of course, the four of us being there, and then the three of us recording, it was very sweet and caring. And it was a special memory for me.
Great. And so for how long were you publishing the newsletter?
It published for about 10 years. I was involved with it for, I think, 8 of those years, and then we turned it into a nonprofit in the hopes that we could stabilize it financially. I had funded the whole thing for years from my savings. And they were running low, and I had also had a couple of people ask me to help them write books. so I had started a second line of my career that actually made some income so I could pay my bills. And I discovered that the more I moved away from doing the Healing Woman, the healthier it was for me. That there's a way in which it was healthy for me to be submerged in this information and to do that kind of good in the world. And then it became healthier for me to go to a broader stage, to speak to a wider audience, to take the learning and to turn over my baby to other people who had fresh energy for carrying on with it. So that's what happened. And then after another couple of years, there simply wasn't the funding for it. And the internet was coming along and it simply went its way and did its service. And I assume the kind of information that we provided is now available online. At least I certainly hope so. There is still a wonderful book out there called The Courage to Heal, which is the Bible of movement for adults who are molested as children, and there are a number of other online sources that people can find.
You know, that's really a remarkable book. I still recommend that. And their other book, Allies in Healing, which is really good for the partners of of women who are going through the healing process. And, you know, what's been remarkable to me is the number of women who simply upon reading that book have suddenly been jolted into memories that sometimes come down on them like a landslide. But following the right kind of therapy, then people heal, and not only heal from those memories or whatever, but their lives are transformed.
And that's been my experience.
Experience a whole new level of power. And you know, there's, you know, often, of course, there was a lot that happened around the whole notion of false memories and, you know, whatever the heck that means, but, you know, made up memories. And, you know, and there certainly are. And when, you know, when you're in a therapeutic situation or if you're doing hypnosis or imagery or anything like that, it's quite possible to get a person to believe things that aren't true if you have a very unskilled or devious therapist or guide. That certainly can be produced. In those cases, the memories don't resolve into anything. You don't get much improvement unless the person suddenly realizes that they were duped. And then they wake up to that, and then there's a lot of healing that can take place as they begin to look at how come they were so willing to be duped. But when when people heal from the actual experiences, their lives change in a very profound way. You know, not just around around sexuality, but around their whole sense of who they are. And so I never spent much time in the therapeutic work I did with people trying to figure out, you know, how true is it? And, you know, I never got involved with, okay, let's sue somebody or let's punish somebody or something like that. But, you know, what do you need to do to heal, to become whole within yourself? Just the amazing things that can happen and are still happening in the work that I do with people. And I really appreciate how much you did to help bring this whole notion out of the closet.
Thank you, Ed. It does my heart good to hear that.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Then let's talk a little bit about what you went on to do and how you got to where you are now.
as I said, I had met several people who had asked me to help them write books, and that continued, and what I found my next calling to be really had a lot in common with the Doing the Healing Woman, which was to help people who had wonderful things to offer the world, but who weren't professional writers, to help them produce books so that they could offer their gifts to the world. So typically, if you are a spiritual teacher, a psychologist, a healer of any sort, how would you know how to write a book? That's not what you spent your life doing, but that's what my talent is. So I began a series of collaborative projects with people who had wonderful things to offer the world, and I had skills to put them in a form that the world could hear and receive. I'm very good at taking complex topics and making them easy to understand. So, as I said, I got involved. I co-authored a book with the woman who developed the eye movement desensitization and relaxation method, which is shortly called EMDR, and interviewed a number of people who'd been traumatized and interviewed the therapists who had treated them using EMDR, and wrote this book full of stories of unimaginable trauma and even more unimaginable healing. It was wonderful. I felt so honored to be trusted with these stories and so touched by the healing. It really was full of hope. And there were a number of other books along those lines, and I feel blessed to be a channel in a way, in some way, you know, for getting these kinds of stories and information out there. I co-authored the second book, a woman who had, she was a corporate revolutionary, really. She wanted her company not just to do well, she wanted them to do good, and she was smart enough and centrally located enough that she found a way to do it. And her book, our book, is called Soul in the Computer, and it's a terrific story. I think it's out of print now. It unfortunately was released the week of 9/11. So this fabulous story of what, how much good a corporation can do in the world if their people are, have their minds set that way, sank to the bottom, to the bottom of the publishing world. But it's still available, and she is an inspiration, and it's a very practical book.
It's still available?
Yes, you can find it in Amazon, used.
The title is?
Soul in the Computer.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely terrific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this woman was amazing and delightful, and she just went around empowering people left and right, and it worked. It was a toolkit for being a corporate revolutionary.
And if you were arrogant enough to be daring enough to look into the future, what would you see in the future for you?
For me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's an interesting thing. I'm still helping people write books. I've been working with some doctors lately and other folks like that. But my life took a very interesting turn about 10 years ago. I got really, really happy. I met the person of my dreams, and we got married. And living just a happy, quieter life started to open up the artist in me. So I have a new book out. This is going to sound really superficial to some people, but it's about painting shoes. It's about taking what is old and worn out and making it absolutely beautiful and new and unique to yourself. I've always loved sewing and what they call wearable art, where you don't just sew something, you paint on it, you bead on it, you make something absolutely unique that expresses yourself. And I discovered no one was doing this with shoes because they couldn't figure out how. Well, there's lots of ways you can do that, and the shoes empower you. They take you somewhere. They are your grounding. They're your connection to Earth. And any woman you know, you ask her, if she has a new pair of shoes she loves, she feels great.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm doing good in the world, and I'm enjoying myself with color, and I teach classes, and the book created a company called Sassy Feet, because I don't think there are enough sassy women in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Having great shoes makes you feel sassy. and rebellious and outspoken.
Uh-huh.
So I go around. I'm basically teaching the art of transformation. Mm-hmm. And people leave the class not just knowing what jars of paint to use versus which ones won't work, but with the sense that they can completely recreate something to meet their own imagination.
Well, it sounds to me like you're still doing the same thing. It's changed form a little bit.
It sounds pretty weird to other people.
It's the same transformation. And we know about women and shoes is all you have to do is say to a woman, nice shoes. You can tell her nice hair, nice dress, but you say nice shoes, you're on first base already. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for spending time with us, Margo. And now, here, as promised, a segment from Inner Child Healing, featuring Margo Silk Forest, myself, and my daughter, Erin. So if you're in a place where you can allow yourself to do so, let your body be still, be in a comfortable position. Take a deep breath in, and as you let it out, think, relax. There's something very important that all children know from the very beginning. The child within me, within you, knows this. A wondrous and beautiful secret we can share with each other and remember. Like waking up into a lovely dream. And now that you're in a safe place, let yourself open inwardly. Be the child. And receive.
Good. At last, we are alone. In this quiet place. And we can talk. I am a child. Like you. And like you, I know the marvelous secret that is inside you. And inside me. Here I am. I am here. And the inner child, the divine, creative, healing child, I am within you. Deep within you. I have been here always, and always will be. I came in beauty. I remain in beauty. In beauty you came. And in beauty, you remain. In beauty and innocence, you arrived at conception. In beauty, you floated within. In beauty, you breathed that first loving breath. And in beauty and innocence, cried that first cry. With our beauty, you and I will always be. Even when there is no one else who sees, I am beautiful. We are beautiful. Even when I forget it, and even when you forget it, the beauty remains. I am love. You are love. An expression of the blessed spirit that moves through all things. This is our home. We belong here, connected in love and beauty to life. We are living love and deserve honor and respect for our being who we are. No less than the greatest eagle, no less than the tiniest kitten or puppy. But sometimes, in the past, sometimes we have felt helpless, sometimes alone, sometimes very afraid. Sometimes we want to just disappear. But don't go. This is your home. You belong here. I know your pain, for I have felt it too. We are all one. And I love you. You are not less because you have suffered.
you are more. Now you are safe. No one can disturb you now. No matter what they say or do, no matter what anybody says or does, you are still a beautiful person. Think it with me, or repeat silently, or out loud after me. No matter what anybody says or does, I am still a beautiful person. I am love, and will always be love. You can never again forget you are beautiful, and I love you. Think it with me, or repeat. I am safe now. I am beautiful. I am loved.
Hear these words. Let them fall like raindrops and remind you of the love that you are. As if in a deep sleep, the memory comes softly. You recall the half-forgotten truth, the wisdom that was long ago planted deep within your being. At your essence is goodness. At your center is love. And now, you will always remember.
I accept myself exactly as I am. Deep within me is peace and love. I open myself fully to the peace and love within. I empty my mind of judgment and self-criticism and let myself be filled with love. I know that when I am full, when I am healed, my love will overflow and nurture others. I know that I must first let myself be full so I can give from my wholeness.
See, sense, feel. Deep within you, there is a part that has been touched. Sense deeply, that deep knowing that goes far beyond the physical senses. And know that this essence is there within you, even when you're not aware of it. This beauty is complete, eternal, ever-present. This essence, now, always available for you to touch, here, letting the intelligent, wise part of you be fully present now and realize the truth.
And with this inner child part of you nurtured, treasured, and protected in a safe place, you can now allow the wise, mature, grown-up part of you to gradually reawaken. As much as you want and need at this time. Yet, allowing yourself to continue to be in touch with this child part within you, the fundamental beauty and value that is there, knowing that this is available to you when you need it, and that you will continue to protect and respect this preciousness within. Your cocoon of light, your invisible protective shield, can stay with you. It will be there any time you need it.
And now, as this part nestles comfortably within, in peace, tranquility, and safety. You may wish to imagine this little child curled up in bed, as if to sleep, but still surrounded by this protective cocoon of light, spun by your special guardian angel who continues to help you protect this beautiful being.
And knowing what is good and healing and valuable has found its home deep within. From time to time, you might wish to reinforce these deeper truths, or to allow the child part of you to come forth in a playful way, but only when you know it is absolutely safe to do so. Otherwise, simply allowing this healing to take place, as if during a sacred sleep, as this child rests undisturbed, healing, becoming more and more whole.
And you may choose to do the same thing, to continue to drift peacefully in this deeply relaxed state. So, if you wish, you can turn this tape off now and continue to let yourself float peacefully and comfortably for as long as you wish. At the end of this time, or now, if you would like, you may let yourself very gently and gradually begin to slowly guide yourself back, as though you have been deeply asleep for a while and are gently reawakening.
And as you gently come back, bring with you as much of this inner peace and tranquility as you wish, gently and gradually tracing the outlines of your body, feeling the surface beneath you, and hearing the sounds around you, perhaps breathing a little more deeply, and letting your body begin to move, to stretch, coming all the way back, feeling wide awake, refreshed. Take a deep breath in, and as you let it out, let your eyelids open, and think to yourself, wide awake. Good. Now, take a moment and notice how comfortable you feel.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.